This is lecture number 6 by Alan McCrae, The Prophecies of Daniel, lecture number 6. We notice that chapter 7 of Daniel starts out with, and I quote here, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions while his head was upon his bed," end quote. I had a very interesting question given to me at the end of last hour, and here's the question, and I'll quote it directly. Does this mean that Daniel saw real things, or does it mean that God caused pictures to appear before him, or that he had a dream and there were pictures in his head? That's the end of the question. Well, how God gave it to him, we really don't know. That is how he gave the vision to him. You might say that everything we see is pictures in our heads. Did you ever think of the fact that you get light in through the right eye and light through the left eye, but you don't see two pictures, you only see one? And they tell us that actually everything from the right side of both eyes goes to the left side of the brain, and everything from the left side of both eyes goes to the right side of the brain. And how are those four things put together into one picture? We don't know. But we see one picture, and God caused Daniel to see one picture. Maybe it was simply a dream. Maybe he was still conscious, but God caused him to see these things. But he knew that it was a vision, not a real sight. We knew it was not things that were actually happening then, but things God caused him to see. These things sometimes might be representations and actual pictures of something that's going to happen in the future, but more often they are symbolic. They represent symbols, like in the statue Nebuchadnezzar saw of the four beasts in Daniel chapter 2. As I mentioned, chapter 7 starts with, quote, "In the first year of Belshazzar, Daniel had a dream," end quote. Then we read about the dream, and the interpretation is mixed in with it. Chapter 8 begins, and I quote here again, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto Daniel, after that which appeared to me before," end quote. So here we have a new vision, a new experience 2 years later. So that chapter division is really in a very good place. And then chapter 9 starts out as, and again I quote, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was taking over the realm of the Chaldeans in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books," etc., etc. And then he goes on and tells us what happened. Then at a later time than chapter 8, Daniel tells us of his prayer and of God's answer to the prayer. And then chapter 10 begins, again I quote, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, it was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar," end quote. And don't confuse Belteshazzar, the name for Daniel, with Belshazzar, the name of the king. And so all four of these chapters start with a new time given when Daniel either received a new message from God or made a prayer as a result of which he received the message from God, that is, as an answer to his prayer. There were several commentators who made a division which put chapter 9 to 11 together as one unit. Well, the beginning of chapter 10 is a clear break with what came previously, just as clear as at the beginning of chapter 9 and the beginning of chapter 8. So I was sorry to see anyone make the division that way. And then at chapter 10, we now have Daniel praying, and the Lord says he will send him an answer, and he sends an angel who tells Daniel, quote, "Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, there will yet stand up three kings of Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they," end quote. And then it goes right on with God's message to him through chapter 11 and through at least part of chapter 12. So if you want to say that chapters 10 to 12 form one unit as compared to the three previous units, that is a good division, even though it makes your last one much longer than the others. Now, I personally believe that in chapter 12 there should be a break. There are a few verses that are separate from the rest. But for that, you'd have to really study the chapter carefully to find where that break would be. We're not that far as yet. However, I was quite disappointed to find a few, not a great many, but a few who began a new vision with chapter 11, verse 1. And of course, it's not much worse than the archbishop who made the chapter division there, But after all, he was riding on horseback, so there's an excuse for him not seeing it very clearly. But now notice the differences. In chapter 10 we start with, quote, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel," end quote. Chapter 11, and I quote again, "Also I," meaning the messenger, "in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and strengthen him," end quote. That's not an introduction of a vision. That's a continuation of what has been said by the messenger before that, who is now introducing his message. And so, if you want to make a break at chapter 11, verse 2, having the prayer and the coming of the messenger, and then a break between that and what the messenger says, that is okay. But to make one at chapter 11, verse 1, as the archbishop did, is excusable, so I won't mark him down for that. After all, his horse may have jumped at that point. Well, now, we want to look at all of these chapters, but we want to go further in our examination of chapter 7 first, and so we will turn back to chapter 7 now. In this chapter, we begin with number 3 of our outline, and it is, quote, "The prophecy of Daniel 7, the setting of the prophecy," end quote. We notice that it is at least 45 years after Daniel chapter 2. We don't know exactly how long, because we don't know when Belshazzar, the king, was associated with his father as co-king. And then second, we noted what is true of all the succeeding chapters, that the vision was given to Daniel himself. That is true of the entire last half of Daniel. In number 3, we've already noted that the interpretation was included in the vision here. And that is true for the rest of the book also. In contrast to chapter 2, where it was Nebuchadnezzar that had the vision, and Daniel then gave the interpretation after Daniel saw the vision as well. Now, moving on to number 4 of the outline, quote, "Part of the vision is retold, but with added detail," end quote. This is a peculiar feature of chapter 7, and it isn't paralleled anywhere else in the book. And then number 5 of the outline, quote, "Symbolism and plain language is not so sharply separated as it was in chapter 2, end quote. That we've already discussed to some extent. And then capital B, and again I quote, "Though the symbolism is entirely different, there are 4 obvious parallels to chapter 2, end quote. And the first of these is that there are 4 kingdoms present. Now in chapter 2, we have 5 parts to the image, and the question we could not give an answer to strictly from chapter 2 alone was, are there 5 kingdoms or 4 kingdoms? But there was a possibility that there were 4 intended because iron is in both of the last 2 parts of the image. And so that was a definite possibility in chapter 2. But you cannot say positively from chapter 2 alone whether that's the case or not. But when you get to chapter 7, you find that there are 4 beasts, and you find that the 4th beast has additional things said about it. And so we learn from chapter 7 that we are justified in carrying this back to chapter 2. That is, chapter 2 has 4 kingdoms and not 5. I say that we are justified in carrying this information from chapter 7 back because it is not introducing something new into what we learn in chapter 2 on its own, but is deciding which of the 2 possibilities is the correct one, and chapter 7 gives us the answer to that. And now on to number 2 under capital B of the outline, quote, "The parallel is that the 4th is to have a second face or a second phase," end quote. And so that is a marked similarity to the 4th and 5th parts of the statue that we saw in chapter 2. And number 3 under this part of the outline, quote, "The complete destruction of the kingdoms," end quote. In chapter 2, the statue is so completely destroyed that no slightest trace of any of it remains. In chapter 7, the 4th beast is burnt. Its body is given to the fire. It is completely destroyed. This complete destruction of these kings is not a taking over of their qualities into any new king. And number 4 of the outline, quote, there is a new universal regime in both visions, end quote. So we have these marked similarities between chapter 2 and chapter 7, which justifies our saying these two are giving a picture of the same thing. A foreview of certain important events in history, running for a long period after the time of Daniel, and a foreview in which certain features are suggested in chapter 2, a few things told about them, but added matters are told in chapter 7. And so, capital C of the outline, we look at, quote, the four kingdoms, end quote. Now, I don't know whether you have noted this next point, as in chapter 2, there is no specific prediction of the overthrow of any of the first three kings. That is to say, the whole statue was destroyed, but what happened was that the Babylonian kingdom was conquered by the Persians and taken over. And the Persian kingdom was conquered by Alexander the Great and taken over. And the different parts of Alexander the Great's kingdom were conquered by the Romans and taken over. But the scripture merely says, after it there will be another king, and after it a third, which shall rule over the whole earth. And so the first three kingdoms, there is no specific prediction in either chapter of an overthrow of any one of them. Now this is something which someone might immediately question, and I myself would have questioned not very long ago what this means, because you notice that in chapter 7 it speaks about the first kingdom in a way which at first sight might seem to tell of its destruction. Let's look at chapter 7, verse 4, and I quote, "The first," that is, the first animal, "was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld, and its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon its feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it," end quote. Now, at first sight, you can say, here's the first kingdom lifted up from the earth. It is destroyed. But that is no way to say something was destroyed. That is to say that it was made to stand on its feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. That's no account of destruction. And certainly, the conquest of the Babylonian kingdom by the Persians couldn't be called a man's heart being given to it. It is quite obvious, when you look closely at it, that this verse describes something quite different. The verse describes something quite different from a destruction, and so I have made that number 2 in the outline here. Quote, "the added detail about the first kingdom," verse 2, end quote. And what it means is shown in Daniel chapter 4, because the fourth chapter of Daniel, we do have the account of how God told Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar was going to go out of his mind, that he was going to grovel on the ground, that he was going to live like an animal. And then Nebuchadnezzar was told that after a certain length of time, God would raise up Nebuchadnezzar again from this degraded condition and again give him a man's heart and return his kingdom to him. And so, this is a description of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, not to the Babylonian kingdom represented by the head of gold. And that fits, of course, with the way that the first part of the statue was introduced in chapter 2, where it said, again quoting, "O king," meaning King Nebuchadnezzar, "thou art this head of gold," end quote. This describes something that happened to Nebuchadnezzar at least 10 years, maybe 20 years, before Daniel had this vision. And so here he is giving him a statement about the first kingdom, which shows to him clearly that the first kingdom is the same as the head of the statue, that is Nebuchadnezzar, that we hear and see described in chapter 2. It shows him something that has already happened, and therefore this strengthens his faith that what follows in chapter 7 is also going to happen. So here, a part of the description is not a prophecy, but a picture of what has already occurred. And then, we notice number 3 of the outline about the second kingdom, and the second kingdom is seen in verse 5, where it says, "Behold, another beast, a second like a bear, and it is raised up on one side." And many think that this statement, and I quote it again, "It raised itself up on one side," end quote, that is, the bear, one side higher than the other, suggests the fact that the Second Kingdom was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, in which the Persians had been subordinate to the Medes, but in which they gained superiority over the Medes before the time that they conquered the Babylonians. I quote it again, "It raised itself up on one side," end quote. Others say, well, it's just a description of how a bear walks, with one side sort of lifted up. To be truthful, I haven't seen enough walking bears to be able to make a judgment between these two interpretations. At any rate, the bear raised up is a true Second Kingdom. Does this give a picture of the Mede-Persian connection or not? I don't think we can say for certain, but at least it's a possibility. The other possibility, of course, is that it does not signify the Mede-Persian connection, but just introduces a bear that is walking with one side higher than the other. Again, we can't leave out either possibility, but we'll see if we get more information later. But here's more information about the Third Kingdom. And I quote, "Three ribs were in its mouth, in between its teeth, and they said to the animal, 'Arise, devour much flesh,'" end quote. And this is a good picture of what Cyrus did, because Cyrus rose in his kingdom and gained supremacy over all the Medes, and then he led his army westward and conquered the region north of Babylon, and then conquered all of Asia Minor to the west, and then he led his army back and down again south and conquered Babylonia. And then he went east and conquered further, going right to the very borders of India. And so this phrase, quote, "arise and devour much flesh," end quote, is a picture of the conquest of Cyrus, going way beyond the territory held by the Babylonians. But it says there were three ribs in its mouth, between its teeth. And many commentators will tell you that these three ribs represent nations. I have a footnote here in one book that says it is Lydia, Babylonia, and Egypt, and it could be others. But he conquered many areas, and I don't think we have a right just to pick three of the areas that he conquered and say these were more important than the others and represent the three ribs that are in the bear's mouth. We can't, because he did conquer so many areas, including several that were very great and important. I think all we can say here is that the three ribs are simply a vivid picture of the fact that he was conquering nations and absorbing them into his kingdom, and that the number three is just that. It doesn't have any specific equivalence to three nations. It was not just a conquest of the Babylonian Empire, it was a conquest of more. But the attempt to precisely say what these three referred to, we have no clear evidence in history to pick out three. And I think we are justified in saying it just means a number, and that he conquered a lot. So I don't think there is any special significance here to the number three. And then we look at what is told about the Fourth Kingdom, and we read about the Fourth Kingdom in chapter 7, verse 6, and I quote, "And after this I beheld, below, there was another animal, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a fowl, or a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it," end quote. Now, I don't think the number four in the expression four wings of a bird has any particular significant importance, but I think it is true you never expect a leopard to have wings. And to say it has four wings stresses the fact of great mobility. And the kingdom of Alexander, with conquests, was made so rapidly that it can hardly be paralleled in history until you get to Napoleon or Hitler with the blitzkrieg that each of these men carried out. Cyrus, indeed, was a tremendous conqueror, and he did conquer many areas. But it was a slow, steady, constant conquest over a series of years. While Alexander, during a short reign of only 12 years, conquered the greatest empire the world had ever seen up to that time. It was marked by its tremendous rapidity. And so the four wings show a tremendous movement. I think we are justified in taking that from the wings, but not in giving any particular attention to the fact that there were four wings rather than three wings, or five wings, or six wings. But then the beast also had four heads. And that's a curious thing, that one beast would have more than one head. The beast had four heads. And I believe we are justified in saying there is the suggestion here, 200 years in advance, of the fact that Alexander's empire would not remain united very long. It had one great head, Alexander, who by his genius conquered all these areas, and to whom all his soldiers were extremely devoted, and who controlled definitely everything that was done during the 12 years of his reign. But after his death, his generals couldn't decide who should succeed him, and they tried to make one person succeed him, but the others would not submit to him, and after a period of disagreement and dissension, they fought with each other for 40 years and finally ended up dividing Alexander's kingdom into various sections, each independent of the other. And yet we can think of them as still being one empire because Hellenistic Greek culture was made predominant in all of these four sections, and there was a similarity of outlook and attitude in all of these kingdoms into which Alexander's empire was divided. So when we say it has four heads, it is predicting something that people 200 years after Daniel's time could look at and say, yes, that corresponds to what actually happened. And that would give them increased faith that what else Daniel said would also come to pass. Then we come to the fourth kingdom in chapter 7, verses 7 and 19. And we have a number of things told us about the fourth kingdom, that is, what Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are really leading up to. We find in these verses that it is strong and destructive. We find that suggested in Daniel chapter 2 by the fact that this fourth kingdom is made of iron, and like iron, it crushes everything. Here we are told that the fourth kingdom has iron claws and part of it is bronze. It is strong and destructive. It is not named, it is simply a beast. A very great and very terrible beast. We also find that it is different from its predecessors. I don't think it was different than the previous ones by being more terrible, actually. I don't think it was different in being more brutal. I don't think it was different in being more determined to take great oversight over every one of its citizens. But it was when it was formed that it became very brutal. When there were uprisings against it, it became extremely brutal. And when someone refused to submit to it, it was also extremely brutal in its harsh judgments. How then was the Roman Empire different from the preceding? Actually, the ways in which it was would hardly be suggested by the brief statements here. But it was very different in three ways. First, there was an entirely different kind of organization in the Roman Empire than what saw in the previous empires, and that's one of the reasons why the Roman Empire lasted longer than any two of the others put together, almost as long as all three of the others put together. The preceding ones were dependent on hereditary control, and the power went from father to son, and sometime the son inherits his father's abilities as strengths, but very often he doesn't. And so through history, the hereditary type of control has not been very effective. But in the case of the Romans, they had a long period of democracy in which, for many years, the Roman people decided what would happen in their realm until they finally got into such a terrible condition that some individuals with great strength were able to seize control. But even then, they had types of organizations so established that it gave a continuing strength to the empire that lasted for four more centuries when it had leaders called emperors. But comparatively seldom were there as many as three men in a row who went from father to son, etc. And in a great many cases in the Roman Empire, when an emperor tried to have his son succeed him, it was found to be an utter failure. Perhaps the best government that any part of the world has ever had in its history was the government of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century AD, a government which, perhaps, had more justice for its citizens, more general equality and opportunity and freedom, and general safety than almost any period in history. And this was the 2nd century AD Roman Empire. And what made the second century such a wonderful period was the fact that each emperor during that period carefully studied to pick a person who would be most fit to carry on as the emperor did, adopted him as a son, and then this person became the emperor's successor. So there is, until you get to the end of the century, there is going to be from father to son, but it's going to be an adopted son. Unlike today, the leaders and their sons did not become powerful because they could speak well over TV, that they could make a good impression with their personality, but because a careful study was made of their qualities and abilities when they were selected for succession. And toward the end of the second century, Marcus Aurelius very foolishly had his own son succeed him, and he proved to be one of the worst emperors Rome ever had, and it broke the succession of success. But even so, even though this was broken, and for the next century the Roman emperors were selected generally by the army, and there was an average of 4 years that the one who was selected would last before he was killed, and another one was brought in, yet the general strength of the empire was such that it lasted in whole for another 2 centuries after the end of that wonderful period of the 2nd century A.D. So, I say, a different kind of organization characterized the Fourth Kingdom, which was altogether different from that of the 3 preceding kingdoms. There was no hereditary monarchy. This point is so important that I listed it separately. And of course, as a result of this, Rome lasted far longer than the other empires. The Roman Senate had the power over the conquered nations, and the emperor always would say, quote, "The Roman Senate has decreed," end quote, and so on, even though he might have been forceful enough to do what he wanted. But it was a system that had great strength in it, and at this time, when the Roman Catholic Church is endeavoring to find a new head, we can notice that part of that feature of the Fourth Kingdom is continued in the Roman Catholic Church. There has been only one time I know of when a pope has tried to get his son made pope succeeding him. And since according to the law, the pope isn't supposed to have a son, since he isn't supposed to be married, he did not succeed in accomplishing such a thing. But there is a marvelous organization in the Roman Catholic Church in that the pope can appoint cardinals, but he can't say what those cardinals are going to do after the pope dies. Many popes have tried to dictate who would be his successor, but rarely, if ever, has one succeeded. And so you have a group of men who have been selected by the previous pope or by previous popes, and who have to make a decision among themselves who will be pope instead of having a great number of people decide, which is apt to be on the basis of who makes the best personal impression, and so on. And so this type of organization is one of the main reasons that the Fourth Kingdom lasted so long. And perhaps there is another reason why we might be able to think of the Roman Empire, to some extent, as continuing through this long period. It was not conquered like the other 3 previous ones, but instead other groups just integrated into it, and various features of it have continued in the many little sovereignties that have taken its place in the years since. So we think of it as continuing through this period, or should we think of the empire actually having come to an end, that the second phase must be something that is still future, with an unmentioned interval in between? I don't think we can be dogmatic on this point, but we can say that there is this long perspective that the prophet had. Let's look at, quote, the second phase, end quote, of the Fourth Kingdom. And here, there's a very interesting thing. And number one under this, quote, "There is no obvious similarity to the 5th part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream," end quote. If you just had the account of the 5th part of the statue in Daniel chapter 2, and you just had what is told about what happened to this 4th beast in Daniel chapter 7, how it got 10 horns, and then one horn came up, and 3 disappeared in front of it, and then how it had a voice that spoke great boasts, and how it tried to change times and seasons and so on, why, nobody would think that that was representing the same thing as the feet and toes of the statue in Daniel chapter 2 being made of iron and clay together. Daniel chapter 2's description is very, very different from the account of the second phase of the fourth kingdom that we find represented by the beast in Daniel chapter 7. But since we have so many similarities between the two descriptions of the fourth kingdom, we are justified in saying these two utterly different pictures of the second phase of the fourth kingdom are referring to events or situations that take place in the same time period, and therefore we can put them together. And then, in the second phase of the fourth kingdom, we find something that we actually had no hint of in the image of the statue, that there would be 10 new kings. Well, now, we have in the interpretation here in Daniel chapter 7, in verse 17, and I read, "The one who stood by said to Daniel, 'These four great beasts are four kings.'" End quote. The beasts are four, and yet it says that the 10 horns on the fourth beast are part of the fourth kingdom. And so we notice that the word king and kingdom are used rather indiscriminately in these chapters. Sometimes they are used to represent, as it does here, a whole long period of two or more centuries, not as a king, but as a kingdom. Sometimes, however, the word simply stands for an individual king. And so, when Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 2, quote, "Thou art this head of gold," end quote, we are left with a question: is Nebuchadnezzar the head of gold, or is it the Neo-Babylonian Empire that is the head of gold, or perhaps the whole period of Assyrian-Babylonian supremacy? I think the latter is most likely, but I don't want to be dogmatic about this. Well then, we have these 10 new kings, and immediately you ask, are we simply told there are 10 horns? This beast had 10 horns. Now, do these 10 horns represent 10 kings who reigned at the same time, or do they represent 10 kings who came successively, one after the other? Honestly, we have no way to prove one or the other from the statements here in chapter 7. Both are possible interpretations. The kings are simultaneous or are they successive? We don't know. We can't say for sure. We find that a little horn came up, and before it, three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And that seems to suggest 10 kings who were reigning at one time, in different areas perhaps, and that a new one came up and got control of three of them. That would make the 10 kings concurrent. It may suggest, on the other hand, what those who hold the critical theory say, that Antiochus Epiphanes and his father, Antiochus III, who had been ruling before him, that his father had died and his brother who ruled just before him had been murdered, and the brother's son, who should logically have succeeded him, got in ahead of him and seized the power, and so they say that three kings disappeared before Antiochus Epiphanes came to power. That makes Antiochus Epiphanes the little horn. I do not think this critical interpretation of the history is correct, but I can say that on this particular idea, that it might be three successive kings rather than three simultaneous kings, that the critics are necessarily wrong in that particular feature. I tend toward simultaneous kings. We cannot draw a great deal more from this passage, but we do have these two possibilities, and I repeat again, are the kings simultaneous or are they successive? Again, we don't want to be dogmatic. But then we move on to number three of the outline, and that is, quote, "the rise of the little horn," end quote. And we find the little horn discussed in verses 8, 11, 20, and 24. And you, of course, have looked at these in connection with your study of this chapter. You have noticed that verse 8 and verse 24 tell about the growing power of this little horn. "This little horn came up and became bigger than the others, stronger than the others. Three disappeared before it." We find its arrogance in verse 25. And I quote here, "He shall speak great words against the Most High," end quote. This is part of the interpretation in the picture where it said the little horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. I quote again, "He shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change the times and the seasons," end quote. It wasn't so many years ago when some were suggesting that this was fulfilled in Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he tried to change the date of Thanksgiving, but he didn't succeed. Since that time, we've had Congress changing the date of a number of our holidays, but I don't think that we have Congress described here. It does describe the arrogance of this one that is called the Little Horn and the Little Horn's attempt to make great changes. Some have thought this could be fulfilled in Julius Caesar, because Julius Caesar changed the times and seasons. In fact, he introduced a new calendar, which we have used ever since, except for a slight modification made 200 years ago, but I certainly don't think that the vision here is speaking about Julius Caesar. Then we have this specific feature, that the little horn makes war against the saints. Verse 21, and I quote, "I beheld the same horn made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High," end quote. How different from the idea that is coming to be widely taught in certain circles that the church is going to gradually reach more and more people with the gospel until the whole world is converted. And this judgment is to happen before the return of Christ. It doesn't fit at all with what is said here that, quote, "the little horn made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High," end quote. They, meaning the saints, didn't seize the judgment. They weren't able to take it by power. It was given to them. And we notice, in connection with the little horn's apparent victory, verses 21 and 25, he, that is the little horn, prevailed against them, that is, the saints. And number four, under the second part of the outline, we notice, quote, "the destruction of the fourth kingdom," end quote. Verses 11 and 26, and I read them again, quoting, "I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even until the beast was slain and its body destroyed," end quote. It doesn't say the horn was destroyed. It says the beast was destroyed. It's like chapter 2, where it doesn't say that the feet and the toes were destroyed. Rather, it says the whole statue was destroyed. So it is to be completely destroyed, that is, the entire fourth kingdom. But here there's a very interesting little feature, verse 12. I was puzzled with this verse 12 when I first studied it, and I quote it, "As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time," end quote. And nothing is told us here of the destruction of the other beasts. But we are told in chapter 2 that the whole statue was destroyed. And so I feel that when it says, quote, "their lives were prolonged for a season and a time," end quote, it means they were prolonged until the fourth beast was destroyed, but then they are all destroyed, which means, of course, that certain individuals are destroyed, along with all the principles that enter into the type of human government represented by Nebuchadnezzar, by the Persians, and by the Greek leaders. That type of human government, all of its features are going to be completely destroyed. But it doesn't specifically say about the other three kings in chapter 7, but it does say they had their dominion taken away and their lives were prolonged for a season and a time, and that makes clear that the four together are one entity. The qualities of the Babylonian kingdom were at least, many of them, taken over by the Persians. And the quality of the Persians were, many of them, taken over by the Greeks. And the qualities of the Greeks were, many of them, taken over by the Roman Empire. Their lives were prolonged for a season in a time, but the whole thing is to be completely destroyed at the time the beast is killed and its body is given to the flames. Now, capital E of the outline, quote, a division of deity, verses 9 to 10, end quote. And notice it is still in the dream, still in the vision that Daniel has. And in the King James Version, the first verse of it gives us a very strong impression at first. And here it is, quote, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, end quote. The error made is that the word, quote, to cast down, end quote, normally means, quote, to place, end quote, or, quote, to put, end quote. It's used in Ezra, where the king says that they shall not place imports or taxes upon these people. It means that he looked and he saw thrones coming into his vision. It might be suggested that verses 9 and 10 fit with the destruction of the beast, but there's no destruction until you get to verse 11. And so the best way to translate this is simply, quote, as he looked, he saw come into view before him thrones, end quote. The thrones came into view. They weren't sat down or cast down. Well, how many people sat on the thrones? Just one did. The Ancient of Days sat, and yet there were many thrones there. And that, of course, has caused many people great curiosity. Why are there multiple thrones mentioned when only one is being sat on? It is a peculiar thing, and some say he was merely the presiding officer, like a judge, who sees that the various attorneys are fair in what they do. He has the 12 jurors with him, and they make the decision, but I don't think that's what the picture sounds like at all. It sounds to me like a picture of the great omnipotent God seated rather than the picture of the presiding officer of a court trial. And the fact that this vision uses the plural thrones, we, with our understanding from the New Testament, may suggest the Trinity, but I think that is perhaps reading back too much into this passage from the New Testament. Perhaps we can think of the greatness of the deity, and that's why the word thrones is used in the plural. And there is certainly no suggestion here that there was anyone else sharing power with the one pictured that sat down. It's called the Ancient of Days. That's why I call it a vision of deity. I don't think it's a picture of a court case at all, and that's why I'm rather disturbed that practically all recent translations translate the end of verse 10 as, quote, the court sat and the books were open, end quote, and that sounds as if he is the presiding judge and others just sat around him to make decisions. I don't think that's the picture you have here at all. I think you have a picture here of the powerful God, the great, pure one, the one with absolute authority who looks down upon earth and sees the little horn ranting against him and trying to change times and seasons and establish things the way that the little horn wants them on earth. In contrast to that, Daniel sees something that illustrates the great power and majesty of God. Certainly, he did not see God. God is a spirit. God does not have a body. He did not see God in that sense, but he saw a representation that symbolized the power and the greatness and eternality of the great God. We read again, the Ancient of Days sat. His garment was white as snow. The hair on his head was pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame. End quote. The King James has the word like in italics, which is not in the original. We better translate, his throne was like a fiery flame, as his throne was a fiery flame. The wheels of the throne were burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before the throne. Thousands upon thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Who are these 10,000 times 10,000? Are they the members of the court that's going to make a decision? It is quite obvious, I think. You don't have to have a judgment to decide what to do with the beast. It is pictured very clearly from his wickedness and from his arrogance to his brutality. Here we have, in contrast to the vain boasts of the beast, the great power of the great God and his authority, and the tremendous number of representatives ready to do his bidding. And so when it says, quote, judgment was set, end quote, the word here translated judgment is not a concrete word, and most of those who take this as a court setting say that the word for decision or judgment is here used abstractly for a concrete item, and that means the court. But the word in the King James represents the thought of the whole situation much better, not just the idea of a court or a judgment. God's judgment was set. It was determined. It continued. It still sat there. The beast with his arrogance, the little horn with its declarations and its attempt to destroy all that God desired, could not succeed because God's judgment had been set or determined from all eternity. It is not a judgment seat, as seen in my opinion, in the sense of a court making a decision. Rather, it is God as the one who carries out the decision that he has made long before the scene even occurs. Now it says, again I quote, the books were opened, end quote. I would take this as being a symbol representing God's omniscience, of the fact that he knows everything, and the fact that he acts wisely in all that he does. I would not take this scene as these various ones with him trying to explain to him just what is happening and all that. It seems to me that this is not what we have here in this picture. Now, number 7 of the outline, quote, the Son of Man, end quote. Here's a picture that is symbolic. We have something happening that, as far as this passage is concerned, could be symbolic, but I believe we have in the midst of the symbols a literal thing. That is to say, Daniel saw something. He saw all of these things, of course, but he saw this thing which was not meant to be a symbol, but a picture in advance of something that was actually going to occur. I don't think we can say dogmatically apart from the New Testament, however, but I think the New Testament makes it very clear what Daniel saw in his night visions. When we read, quote, and behold, one like the Son of Man, end quote. Now, this phrase, Son of Man, is used in Daniel chapter 8, verse 17, where God's messenger says to Daniel, quote, understand, Daniel, Son of Man, end quote. Son of Man is just an ordinary man, one of a class that is human. But here, Daniel saw one who looked like a man, but the picture here came to be recognized by the Jews as a picture of the coming of the Messiah. And Jesus Christ used this term of himself, the Son of Man, clearly referring back to its usage in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, not to its usage here in chapter 8, where it just means an ordinary human, and it is used of Daniel. Now in Ezekiel, there are dozens of times Ezekiel is addressed as Son of Man. But it is this one picture in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, that shows the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. And here we have one coming who has great authority. Now, whether you would say Daniel saw one who would be coming with the clouds of heaven, who came to the Ancient of Days and was given authority prior to his coming, or whether you say Daniel saw the Son of Man coming and he realized that he already was brought before the Ancient of Days and had been given dominion, glory, and kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. Whichever way you take it, I believe the usages in the New Testament show, and also Psalm 110, verse 1, that the giving of authority to the Son of Man precedes his coming with the clouds of heaven. This is a literal picture of one coming in the clouds of heaven, as shown by the New Testament references, which we have talked about before, especially Acts chapter 1, but that, of course, his coming is also symbolic as he is brought before the Ancient of Days in this vision of Daniel. That is symbolic because the Ancient of Days is a spirit that wouldn't have a physical entity related to it. But it is exactly what is described in Psalm 110, verse 1, that, quote, "The Lord said to him," Son of Man by implication, "sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool," end quote. Now, we discussed the Son of Man a bit already. There's only a little more that I want to look at further in this chapter, but I think this would be a good place to make a break. We'll have more to say about this next time we meet. Thus ends lecture number 6 of Alan McCrae's The Prophecies of Daniel.